This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick and here's what's coming up.
It's a clear indication that Zimbabwean authorities are not prepared to have journalists who expose government corruption and speaking truth to power.
That's Robert Chivambu, Amnesty International spokesperson in Southern Africa, on Zimbabwe's efforts to silence critics. That story and more are next on Africa News Tonight. In our top story, rights groups in Zimbabwe have denounced the High Court denying bail to journalist Hopewell Chinono, who is facing charges of stoking violence in advance of planned anti-government protests. Security forces thwarted the July 31st protests against corruption and poverty, arresting Chinono and an opposition leader. South Africa is now sending envoys to Zimbabwe to investigate reports of escalating rights abuses, which the government denies. Columbus Muvanga reports. From Harare.
Supporters of Zimbabwean journalist Hopewell Chinono fear his continued detention is a way for authorities to silence critical reporting against corruption. Robert Chivambu is Amnesty International spokesman in Southern Africa.
It's a clear indication that Zimbabwean authorities are not prepared to have journalists who expose government corruption and speaking truth to power. The government of Zimbabwe should stop intimidating journalists like Hopewell Chinono and allow them to be able to do their job to expose corruption. Because this is good for the country, in fact, so that law enforcement agencies can be able to follow up what journalists like Hopewell are reporting, not criminalizing for exposing that.
Zimbabwe's High Court Thursday afternoon ruled against Chinono's appeal for bail. He is being detained for 3 weeks on charges of stoking violence ahead of a planned protest last week that security forces stopped before it could begin. Chinono is an outspoken critic of corruption, which the protest was to be against, along with the government's handling of Zimbabwe's imploding economy. Speaking to reporters after Chinono was denied bail, Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights Beatrice Mutetwa said it was clear that authorities want to silence critical voices.
I think everybody knows that what happens in Zimbabwe, how those who say they're fighting corruption are walking the streets. We say they are corrupt, looting their pockets. And those saying you should be seen to be fighting corruption are getting more and more persecuted.
Opposition politician Jacob Ngaruvume was arrested on the same charges as Chinono and also remains in prison. Meanwhile, Zimbabwe authorities have released a wanted list of activists and more than a dozen have gone into hiding. Government spokesman Nick Mangwana rejected the idea that authorities are targeting activists or journalists.
There is a journalist who happens to be an activist, whose actions may cross the boundaries of the law. They are not immune from prosecution if they do that. If they incite and there is a law against incitement, the fact that they are a journalist does not give them immunity from that prosecution. That's the difference. So every other journalist who goes about doing their job, they are not active, there is no problem. There is even no problem with being an activist itself. But within the context of being an activist, if you start breaking the law, then the law will take its course.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, the current chairperson of the Africa Union, has appointed special envoys to Zimbabwe to investigate the accusations. Head of Human Rights Watch in Southern Africa, Dewa Mavinga, says more is needed.
We are calling for the Southern African Development Community, SADC, and the African Union to urgently speak out on the abuses in Zimbabwe and urge President Mnangagwa to end repression and to promote human rights respect. Human rights in Zimbabwe should be guaranteed and respected.
Critics accuse Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa of ruling the country with an iron fist, much like former President Robert Mugabe. After Mugabe was removed in a 2017 coup, Mnangagwa vowed Zimbabwe would no longer be the dictatorship of his predecessor. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
Meanwhile, South African police used tear gas, stun grenades and rubber bullets to disperse protesters outside the Zimbabwean embassy in Pretoria, demanding an end to corruption, arbitrary arrests, abductions and other human rights abuses in the troubled country. President Cyril Ramaphosa has appointed two special envoys to engage Harare on the alleged abuses. Tuso Kumalo brings us the story from Johannesburg.
Demonstrators dove and ducked as rubber bullets flew over their heads to prevent them from gathering in front of the Zimbabwean embassy in South Africa's capital. Zimbabweans and South Africans alike had come to demand an end to growing human rights abuses in Zimbabwe. But police responded that they had no permission to gather. Traffic came to a standstill as demonstrators gathered in smaller groups at street corners, bursting into revolutionary songs. Zimbabwean national Cosmas Ndlovu did not mince words on why he joined the protesters against President Mnangagwa and his government and security forces. Mnangagwa claims dark forces and terrorists are abetting many of the country's problems, including an economic crisis and growing hunger.
The reason why I'm part of this protest is that I miss home. I want to go back home. But home is hell. Home is a lion's den. And now what I'm saying as a citizen is that Mnangagwa must respect Zimbabweans. He must respect the rule of law. He must respect citizens. He has to go. He has to go. It's non-negotiable.
From Lungisi Ndlovu, ending the crackdown on dissenting voices in Zimbabwe tops his list of demands.
If they say dark forces must be flushed out, they mean everybody who's in opposition, everybody who opposes their evil deeds will be flushed out. By flushing out, they mean they will kill them. Now the journalists are being arrested. Popo Chinono has been arrested. So we need AU, SATIC, United Nations to intervene. They must say something. They can't be silent. This thing has been happening. They all know what is happening.
Another protester, Velile Moyo, said they have had enough suffering since the ruling ZANU-PF took power in 1980.
Our people, whenever they try to stand up to say something against what is happening, they are arrested, they are killed. Many of them have been displaced. They're out of the country. And many of them are stateless. Many of them are here in South Africa. Many of them are in Botswana, all over the world. And many of them are stateless. They do not even have any identity documents. The government that is ruling in Zimbabwe is a government that is very dangerous.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, who is also the current chair of the African Union, finally made a move to deal with the situation. He appointed former Speaker of Parliament Baleka Mbete and former Minister Sydney Mufamadi as special envoys to Zimbabwe. The presidency said the two will soon head to Zimbabwe to engage all stakeholders on the human rights crisis. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Egyptian Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry yesterday discussed the importance of supporting a UN-brokered ceasefire in Libya through political and economic talks. However, both the UN-backed Government of National Accord and its rival, the Libyan National Army, are bolstering their forces for the battle for the strategic city of Sirte, which Egypt calls a red line not to be crossed. Former Libyan ambassador to Mexico, Muftar Al-Tayar, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi the chances for conflict and negotiated settlement in Libya.
It looks like the confrontation is now around Sirte, and from there, whoever is consider himself victorious will move on to Al-Jufra. But that's why the United States and other players are trying to stop everybody from reaching this point, which is a battle in Sirte. Sirte is the key factor. Al-Jufra come after that. But first, Sirte.
So what are the chances for a political solution versus a regional conflict in Libya if the red line on Sirte is crossed?
I'll be optimistic. I'm going to say 50-50, but but I would like very much to see the opposite. I would like to see the chances of achieving a resolution is everybody was looking for. The Libyan people have suffered a lot. Imagine until this moment, the capital of Libya is suffering from electricity blockage and output for more than sometimes 30 hours continuous, not to mention the shortage of money and cash and things like that. So we would like very much to see this achieved, to see everybody put his arms down, sit down, and think about Libya and the interests of the Libyan people.
But so far, both sides are placing preconditions to get to the negotiating table.
This is normal, especially in the beginning. Maybe everybody is making it difficult, to say, I might say, for the other part. So we will put strong conditions, not negotiable, nothing, but it's not. This is not the case. The case is that whenever they are there on the table, everybody will have to compromise. The compromise is the key word for this. Nobody will see all his condition met. It's impossible. They have to give something in order to gain something.
But would any negotiation lead to partition of Libya or a confederate system?
Of course, we are, all of us and Libyans are against separation. And now they came almost to the realization that it's not that bad to have a federal system. And I'm saying to them, let us start with a federal system. Just like when we were in the monarchy under King Idris, rahmatullahi alayhi, he started with a federal system. And then in 1963, he changed that to a full engagement system, political system. So now the atmosphere is better to discuss this alternative. And the Libyans, to be honest with you, are looking very much for a system that avoids the division of Libya or separation of Libya and also give every part in the country what it deserves.
And that was former Libyan ambassador to Mexico, Mufta Al-Tayar, speaking there with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi. Booby traps, counterfeit currency and military ammunition are among the tactics Russian mercenaries are using in Libya. VOA Salim Solomon has the details.
International observers are sounding the alarm about an alliance between Russian mercenaries and a Libyan militia, which they say imperils civilians and risks intensifying Libya's civil war. In recent weeks, forces loyal to Libyan General Khalifa Haftar have retreated from neighborhoods surrounding Tripoli. In their wake, human rights groups and the U.S. military say they left behind Russian-made landmines, many of them planted in residential neighborhoods. The U.S. Africa Command and independent analysts accuse mercenaries of the Wagner Group, a private Russian company, of being behind the mines.
They've been involved in kind of booby-trapping civilian neighborhoods, setting up defense systems in the middle of oil fields and oil terminals, and really kind of preparing for an enlarged conflict. And they are being supported militarily by Russia.
That was Tariq Magrisi, a policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Magrisi said the Russians are making little effort to conceal their actions.
We see Russian planes regularly traveling from Russia to Syria, then Syria to Libya, where they're bringing arms, and they're also allegedly bringing Syrian mercenaries to join up with the Russian groups that are fighting there.
Recently, a top AFRICOM official said Russia was further destabilizing Libya to gain a stronghold in northern Africa, just as it has in eastern Europe and the Middle East. Civilians, many of whom are returning to their homes after a forced evacuation, are falling victim to the mines. According to a July 13 UN report, landmines or booby traps had killed 52 people and injured 96 in southern Tripoli. Since then, Libyan media outlets have reported more carnage, including a July 16 mine explosion that injured 3 children. Haftar's forces, called the Libyan National Army, are based in east of the country. Magrisi said the goal of the LNA booby traps is simple: kill and maim as many people as possible to discourage forces loyal to the GNA.
this is really just a way to slow down government troops to make sure that they couldn't stay hot on their heels, but also just to kind of suck the joy of victory out of the morale from the government-aligned forces. Because, you know, they've gone from finally freeing Tripoli from this conflict and lifting the siege to losing over 100 people in the space of a month as they go house to house trying to unpick these booby traps.
Megarisi says Russia also is printing billions of counterfeit Libyan dinars to finance Haftar's army and undermine the overall Libyan economy by causing inflation.
These cash injections and these kind of this parallel currency that they printed on behalf of Haftar has allowed this oppositional entity to remain solvent and to be able to, you know, continue buying weapons, buying mercenaries and prosecuting this war against the Libyan government.
Haftar's forces and their Russian allies have returned to the eastern part of the country. At the same time, Russia, as well as Egypt, another Haftar ally, have called for a ceasefire. This has led some to wonder whether this might pave the way for a partitioning of the country between Haftar and the GNA. Jason Pack, a non-resident fellow at the nonprofit Middle East Institute in Washington, warned that Russia's history in other parts of the world indicate a ceasefire may be a precursor to further attacks.
What we've seen in Syria is when Russia calls for a ceasefire and negotiated settlement, what they're really doing is buying time when they're in a position of tactical weakness, as the Russian-backed Haftar forces are in Libya now. Haftar's forces are losing. Russia wants a timeout so they can build up defenses so that they can eventually surge and hopefully take Tripoli.
Pak says he fears that Russia and its Libyan allies will use any ceasefire to prepare for a new onslaught to take the capital. Salem Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara says he will seek re-election in October, defying opponents who say the constitution forbids a third term. Nicolas Pinot reports from Paris.
I have decided to respond favorably to the call of my fellow citizens, Ouattara said in a televised speech formally accepting the ruling party's nomination. Given my previous promise, the decision represents a real sacrifice for me, he added. Ouattara, who has run since 2011, said in March he would not pursue another term, but his preferred successor, then Prime Minister Amadou Gan Coulibaly, died in July, leading the party to ask Ouattara to reconsider. Last night's announcement is not a surprise for Ouattara's opponents, who say the two-term limit in the constitution bars him from running again. Ouattara, who has claimed his first two mandates, do not count under the new constitution adopted in 2016. The election is seen as the greatest test yet for stability since the civil war in 2010 and 2011 killed about 3,000 people following Ouattara's first election's victory. The first round of polling will be held on October 31st. Nicolas Pinault for VOA News, Paris.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington. For more news and information, visit our website at voanews.com. Botswana has banned alcohol sales as COVID-19 cases have doubled in the last 2 weeks after the Southern African country was lauded for its efforts to keep the virus from spreading. From Gaborone, Botswana, reporter Mkondisi Dube has the details.
Botswana's Director of Health Services, Malaki Tsipayahai, announced the ban late yesterday, arguing that drinkers failed to observe social distancing, leading to a spike in cases. In mid-July, Botswana had 70 active cases of the coronavirus, but has seen that rise to 114. The Presidential COVID-19 Task Force said yesterday that the figure could be higher as contact tracing is ongoing. The capital, Gaborone, has been put on a two-week lockdown. The Botswana Alcohol Industry Association chairperson, Mutusi Molokome, does not agree with the booze ban.
We are yet to establish the reasons informing this current position. I know on the Gazette it does allude to the fact that alcohol consumption has been linked to sort of the spread of the disease or the potential spread. We are yet to get a firm answer from the minister. We are engaging.
Gaborone alcohol trader Edwin Michaleng said the government's move is a blow as they did not see liquor sales as the reason behind the rise in COVID-19 cases.
We've done our best as traders to ensure that buyers adhere to regulations. It came as a shock that the government has banned the sale of liquor. And this might result in retrenchments.
Neighboring South Africa banned liquor sales during its first lockdown. East, the restrictions then reimposed them last month after a dramatic rise in cases. More than 500,000 people have tested positive for COVID-19 in South Africa. Botswana was one of the first countries in the Southern African region to lift lockdown restrictions in May. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Haburoni, Botswana.
The multinational joint task force fighting Boko Haram says over 100 of the Islamist militants and their captives, almost all Nigerians, have fled the group in the past 2 weeks. The task force says about half of those who surrendered were Nigerian fighters, but three Cameroonian fighters, children and women used as sex slaves, were also among those who escaped. Moki Edwin Kinziger reports from Marua in northern Cameroon.
34-year-old Nigerian Karim Kalga is among 109 people who have fled Boko Haram since late July and surrendered to the multinational joint task force fighting the group. Kalga says he has not seen his wives and children in the 2 years since he joined the Islamist militant group because they kept him captive. Kalga says he was living in poverty and found it very difficult to take care of his two wives and five children. He says Boko Haram fighters promised to give him a motorcycle to earn money for his family, so he could not resist joining the militants. Kalga says while in a Boko Haram camp in Nigeria, he was forced to steal cattle and millet from surrounding villages to feed their fighters. He surrendered to the military, says Kalga, because Boko Haram did not fulfill its promise to give him a motorcycle. The task force is holding the former Boko Haram fighters and captives at their base in Cameroon's northern town of Mora. It says among them are 45 Nigerian and 3 Cameroonian former fighters, 45 Nigerian children and 16 women who are being used as sex slaves. Commander of the Multinational Joint Task Force, Major General Ibrahim Manu Yusuf, says the Nigerians are all from Borno State, a Boko Haram stronghold. He credits a campaign calling for Boko Haram members to surrender and be pardoned.
As professional armies, we always open this window for those who wish to come up and surrender. You know, the narrative in the Boko Haram enclave is that if you come out, soldiers will kill you. And based on the way they are being treated, the way they are being managed, they kept calling on their other colleagues to turn over themselves.
Yusuf says the governments of Cameroon and Nigeria will decide whether the former Boko Haram members will remain in Cameroon or go back to Nigeria. Meanwhile, the former militants were handed over to the Cameroon Center for Disarmament, Demobilization and Reintegration. The Mora-based center was created in 2019 to rehabilitate 100 ex-militants at a time, but currently hosts more than 250. Center Director Umar Bishar says he needs more resources to rehabilitate the increasing numbers fleeing Boko Haram.
Les difficultés, c'est le problème de la capacité d'accueil.
He says the capacity of the center to receive former Boko Haram fighters has been overstretched. Bishar says the government of Cameroon should provide more housing and workers, especially psychosocial caregivers. He says the center also needs more workers who can train ex-fighters with skills such as farming, carpentry, and raising fish and livestock. The multinational joint task force fighting the Islamist militants is made up of troops from Benin, Cameroon, Chad, Niger, and Nigeria. The UN says the decade-long conflict with Boko Haram has left 30,000 people dead and displaced more than 3 million throughout the region. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Marua.
Police in the western U.S. city of Denver say they are looking at arson as the cause of a house fire that killed people from Senegal. The three adults and two children were not immediately identified. They were inside the residence in a recently built housing development near the international airport outside the Colorado state capital. Firefighters say the flames were too intense to mount a rescue effort inside the house. Three other people on the second floor were able to jump to safety and were being treated for non-life-threatening injuries. Senegal's president Macky Sall tweeted his condolences and said he is monitoring the investigation closely. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Haley Adams, Patrick in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. Thank you for listening, and thank you for choosing the Voice of America.